I'm KQ Romeo India Whiskey. At this time, we begin the TechNet, as we've done for 36 years, starting September of 1982. The Technical Net is a gathering of curious radio amateurs who want to know more about radio, wireless equipment in general, other science subjects. I've often said inside of every true ham radio operator, there's a scientist trying to get out. The TechNet usually runs 4 hours if there's enough enthusiasm. We start at 8 p.m. and go to midnight. And it's broken up into roughly three sections. The first section is people sign in with their call letters and name because they want to, because they have a question or a comment for the net. The second section is run by Roy, AC2GS. Dr. Roy runs the science talk. And the third section is run by Paul, WS2N, the space report. And some interesting things have happened in space this week, so we've been hearing about those. Let me drop. You need that sign in just to say you're listening. After 36 years, we believe somebody is listening. Under normal circumstances, this repeater also is connected by IRLP and Echo Link, so we quite often can have people checking in from other areas, other states, and sometimes other countries. For those who can't stay up late enough to hear the end of the TechNet and you want to, it's all recorded. There's a very enthusiastic guy named Mike, KC2NJI, who has a website where the last 11 years of TechNet have been recorded. So you choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back the recordings. And that's on amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor. Another website supporting the TechNet is Mike number 2, K1MJM, and that's limartechnet.com. And you'll find, in both cases, you'll find supporting material, diagrams and graphs and whatever, like the Brown and Woodward curves that I talk about so often, where you can predict the impedance of any wire antenna. If you know the length of the wire and the diameter of the wire, you can know the exact impedance at your frequency. Let me drop. And that allows you to design a simple impedance matching network if you want to, by going to that impedance matching network that I can't think of the name of right now. Stanford, is it? No, it's not Stanford. It's a college in California that has a website where you go there and type in, you search the word impedance matching, and you tell it the impedance of your antenna, and it'll give you a whole lot of solutions to it, just various inductor and capacitor combinations that'll give you a perfect impedance match at your particular favorite frequency. Let me drop. Okay, at this time we're going to take check-ins. So please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Please wait for the four beeps before you talk, otherwise you might be timing out. And this is a K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. This is the TechNet, and we're listening for our check-ins at this time.
N2EO.
Okay, that was Rich, N2EO. Anyone else to check in? Please give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps. The last person who attempted to sign in, you were 90% noise and 8% audio, if you know what I mean. If you're on a handy talkie, you've got to move to a slightly different location to so that we can hear you. Make another attempt, please. Take two eyes, I'll be listening. No improvement. 90% noise, only a couple of percent audio, and we got zero copy. You're going to have to move to a different location, run higher power or whatever. Part of the problem is that on a repeater, you're transmitting on one frequency and listening on another. So when you move your handy-talkie around to get the strongest possible signal on reception, that may not be the best location for the strongest signal to transmit back to the repeater. So you got to try another location. Give it one more try. K2RIW listening. Same thing. 90% noise, 5% audio, so to speak. Did anyone on frequency hear that person trying to sign in?
John 375.
Oh, he's on 375. Okay. Make one more attempt. I'll listen to 375. Okay, did anybody copy the person's call letters?
82MC, I just pushed you 375. Tell them to try again.
Okay, make one more try. You're on a handy stock, you try moving to a different location. The person trying to sign in, go right ahead. K2RIW.
I thought I heard OQO, Vic.
Okay, maybe it was OQO. Hopefully, by the time we get to him, he'll be able to do something to strengthen his signal. Aim the antenna better or higher power or whatever. So we got Rich so far. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
W2GW, John, I have a question.
Okay, John, that's a very nice set of call letters. Whiskey 2, Golf Whiskey. Okay, we got John, Rich, anyone else? Please give me your call letters and name right now for a check-in, because you got a question or a comment for the net.
What's the end time with that program, Dick?
Sometime on Saturday. I'm not sure of the time on Saturday that the program was on, but it was on the subject of the contaminants that's in our tap water. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, if you could give me the time, you know, I can probably find out whose show it was.
Yeah, I don't remember the time. I'm particularly light on information here. They gave a URL, which I didn't write down, and I forgot. I forgot the time that I watched it, and so on. So, sorry about that. Thank you for trying, Eric.
Was it in the afternoon, the evening, the morning?
Late morning or early early afternoon?
Yeah.
Okay, one last call for anybody who wants to check into the TechNet. Give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW, if you're listening.
WS2N. Paul, and I do have one question.
Okay, you're on the list, Paul. Okay, the first person to check in with a question was Rich, N2EO. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick. N2EO, and good evening to everybody on the net. I'm curious. What is the difference between the voltage dialing and a current dialing? You know the situation. It was a dialing that went bad. Andy found. The antenna was put up yesterday. Barry is back from South Carolina. And he and Andy strung it back up. And tomorrow I'm ordering the dialing. Jeremy, as Patty son, is lending me the money. So that'll be good. And this dialing goes, output goes to the bottle line, which is in here. Input to the dialing comes from the amplifier and from radio. Now the first one blew, I'm getting one from Palstar. Rated. Okay, I wanted to wait for the beat. This one is coming from Palstar, same company that made my tuna, and the first dialing that blew up was Palstar. Apparently they've been having trouble. And with the whole, they came out with a new line of balance. BX Engineering used to make balance, monstrous balance. When I moved here, it was behind me on the wall. Nobody took it off. So that one was rated 10 kilowatts sideband, 5 kilowatts of W. But it was in my boiler room. Nobody noticed. Anyway, what I'm getting is $89 plus shipping. What do you think, Dick? What is the current? We'll
hold out. I'm not positive on this one, Richman, but I tell you what I think I know. And by the way, in your particular circumstance where you're feeding that Cobra antenna from an antenna tuner and from your amplifier or your exciter, whether you use a current balance or a voltage balance, because you're feeding the center of the antenna, either one will work in my guess in your situation. If you had an off-center fed antenna, like say for instance a Wyndham, then I think you'd be forced into a so-called current balance. I'm going to try to give you an example of what I think is a current balance and a voltage balance. Let me drop. Assuming my balance was a very simple transformer-like thing, where there's a primary winding coming from the antenna tuner in your case, and a secondary winding that goes to the antenna. And depending on the turns ratio of the primary and secondary winding, that could be a 1-to-1 balun, a 4-to-1 balun, a 9-to-1 balun in impedance. If it had a 3-to-1 voltage ratio, 3-to-1 turns ratio, because impedance is a function of voltage squared, a 3-to-1 voltage ratio would be a 9-to-1 impedance ratio. That would be a 450 ohm output for a 50 ohm input, for instance. Okay. That secondary winding, if that secondary winding was thoroughly floating, not grounded anywhere, just going to your two leads of your open wire, of your twin lead feed to your Cobra antenna, that would be a current feeding, in my opinion. If that secondary winding had a set of tap that was grounded, you're now forcing the voltage on each side of the twin lead to be some exact voltage. In your case, that would work well. If it was feeding an off-center fed antenna, that wouldn't be sufficiently adaptive. So that's one example of what I think is the difference between a current balun and a voltage balun. One forces the voltage on each side to be some specific value. A current balun allows the whole secondary winding to float, so to speak, so it's going to produce a certain differential voltage between your two halves of your twin lead. But whether or not the common mode voltage wants to go to somewhere else, an ungrounded secondary would allow that to happen. That's my guess as to an example of the difference between current balun and voltage balun. For some of you guys that are hearing my voice and you got better knowledge on this, please give us your call letters right now. K2LIW and the TechNet. Wait for the beeps. Sounds like no one has any further information on this one, Rich. You're feeding the center of an antenna, so in your case, either one will work. Now, the failure that you probably have gotten, where Palstar knows that they were getting failures of that particular model number of balun that you were using, Jerry Civic, W2FMI, had a series of articles in QST Magazine 15, 20 years ago, in which he talked about the fact that certain kinds of ferrites, when overloaded, overheated, will make a permanent change in their permeability characteristics. And I think Andy and I are, Andy in particular, are making a guess that that's what Palstar is telling them, that that's the failure mode. He did see what looks like high temperature discoloration of the of the ferrite that was in your particular balun that looks like it has failed. So Palstar is now coming out with a different design using more ferrite, which hopefully doesn't have that problem. In your particular case, the lightning strike could have aggravated it. A high power for a certain length of time could have aggravated it so that it overheated the ferrite. So Andy has measured the failure of your particular balun. And so even though it gives a good visual inspection, it looks like it does need replacement, and it looks like what you're in the process of doing. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich, wait for the beeps.
Okay, then. Now I'm very perplexed and a little bit scared that something will happen to the new balun. The old balun I was running for either 2 or 3 years. I don't know what happened. Maybe it was lightning strike. I have no idea. I wish we could find out. Maybe, not a rush, but maybe Andy, one day, when you two have time, he gave it to you. Any line into a network analyzer has really shot. Has put power through it, all of it came back. That's very weird.
Yeah, when he put it, I think you're saying he did run the, he was talking about going to run a network analyzer test in which he was going to sweep it. Are you saying he did run that test and again he saw the failure? Over to you, Rich.
I believe so, as I understand quite good what Andy said. Seth, according to what I remember, said he put it on the network analyzer, put some power into it, I don't know how much, and all the power came back reflected. All of it.
AC2GS.
Go right ahead, Roy. Dr. Roy.
Thank you, Dick. My understanding, and I've spoken to Andy about this many times, he didn't get around to a vector network analyzer. What he had done was put a non-inductive, non-reactive 200-ohm resistor at one end, put the ballon between that and his radio, and tried to transmit 100 watts using that. And what he found was, number one, his transmitter folded over because of the high viswa, and when he took a watt meter to the watts that were coming out were reflected all back. So he had an infinite viswa.
Yeah, thank you, Roy. I did hear that that particular piece of information from Andy. And so Andy did give it a good visual inspection. There were no short circuits on the connectors, no arcing over the wiring and so on. So everything looked good. About the only way I can think of that could be happening, if there's not a hidden miswiring somewhere, is that if essentially all of the permeability of the ferrite disappeared because of this failure mode, similar to what WQFMI Jerry Civic was describing in his QST articles on these short monopole antennas. He had a whole series of articles on very short monopole antennas with extensive ground planes in his backyard, so to speak. And he also had a number of parallel information in those articles about various ways of winding Grunella-like ballons. And he talked about this failure mechanism of the inductive material, of the permeability material, when overheated. And it goes into some kind of a permanent failure mode where maybe it loses almost all of its permeability. Wonder if you've heard about that one, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Why, yes, I did, Dick. Matter of fact, when I was kind of brainstorming way back towards the beginning, and he told me that he popped the cover of the ballon and it looked like all the wiring was intact, that was my kind of go-to solution to the problem why a ballon that looks perfectly fine with no shorts or opens doesn't work. If you take out the inductance, then you get a short circuit, which probably is what's going on. He tested the inductance using a device that measured it in kilocycles and came a decent amount of microhenries. But again, that's probably very frequency specific. So I was always interested in what his VNA would say as he swept it up through the HF frequencies.
Yeah, just like you said, where his inductance measuring device measured each one of the toroid coils at something like 89 microhenries, a reasonable sounding number, which gives you a few thousand ohms of reactance at 20 meters, you would think it's working. But I guess the failure mode of the ferrite could still have some amount of permeability at, say, 100 KEC, but not at 14 megacycles. So when he sweeps it with his vector network analyzer, he'll be able to see this. And if the vector network analyzer can go all the way down to 100 KC, where his inductor measure ran, that would be interesting to find out does it still give 100% reflection. So he may be able to sweep his VNA down to very low frequencies to find out does it appear to recover, so to speak. And the ballon, I'm sure, I'm having trouble believing that it's a ballon that's rated for 80 through 10 meters, for instance, that I can work at 100 kc. I kind of doubt that. So it's a bit mysterious, as you can see. Back to you for any further comments, Roy.
That's it, Sam.
Wes, you know about these ferrite failures? Interextra and go ahead, Wes.
Yes, indeed, that's the most interesting fact about the ferrite failure, and I would like to ask Roy about the possible causes of that material. We know that the ferrite is made from the fine powder, metal powder, iron powder, and is in the green state, is pressed with the binder, and the binder is mostly kind of the material that gets hard. So all of those particles are very much isolated. Is it the cause of it based on the manufacture failure in manufacturing of the ferrite? Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I think Wes is onto something here, where the individual particles by way of the binder have to be insulated from each other, so you're not getting eddy currents. And if you overheat it, and so the binder remelts and the particles now touch each other, you could develop some huge eddy currents, and therefore the permeability could go to zero. That's what I think Wes is suggesting. I wonder if that's a possible failure mode that you've heard about. AC2GS, K2LIW, W. Roy.
It could indeed be binder failure. It could also be failure of the microcrystallines that are making up the ferrite. They're very specific for different mixes, and if you heat them, they may kind of switch into a different crystalline with a different permeability signature. So it's probably a bit of both. I think just heating these crystals alone is enough to cause them to kind of jump into another mixed state.
The problem with that. You take the ferrite. There are some of the other materials or that iron filings has a very much specific chemical structure. To change it, you have to have a code for it. Change means transmutation. Gives a few words in this area.
A ferrite material isn't just iron filings. They're grains of iron oxides and other compounds. And those molecules can take on different orientations within their grain. I mean, if you think about steel, steel has multiple different structures that have different properties. So the same with ferrite. So heat can cause one state to shift into another. It's not all just iron. There's a lot more complicated things going on a crystal lattice structure principle.
Roy, when it comes to permeability materials, we hear about ferrite, we hear about powdered iron. I think they are different substances. Is that true, Roy? Go ahead.
Also manganese and zinc.
Yes, as Eric said, it's much more complicated, unfortunately. It's, they come up with mixtures. The magic mixture that hams like to use is called mix number 31, but there are other mixtures available, and there's nothing particularly special and stable about them. So you heat these things up, and they're subject to change in permeabilities.
That's true. Mostly you have a barium manganese, nickel, and zinc. That is in addition to iron, a typical proportion. How is that done is you have a big cylinder with the water, and that's usually from porcelain, and you put that filing into it, you rust it for 24 hours, and the rust is actually that what prevents the contact, electrical contact with other particles, and then the amount of binding compound is very minimum. Now, are you suggesting that due to the temperature, all of a sudden, that the rust high resistance is lost? I'm trying to find, what is it? Is it transmutation, or are we talking about the physical damage of any other kind? Dr. Roy.
I'm not suggesting, for the most part, resistance changes. I'm suggesting that each of these grains have a certain crystalline structure based upon the temperature at which they were cooled at. And that's kind of locked in unless you heat them up and you give them a possible out to shift the orientation of the different atoms in the crystal lattice, and then they can reform or adjust themselves to a different structure that has a different quality. Again, some forms of steel are very flexible. Other forms of steel are very inflexible but very hard. And they're still both steel. So there's more to it than simply the number of atoms and the type of atoms. It's how you stack the deck, if you will.
How you can create the heat if there is no electrical path between the particles? What is the cause of changing the crystalline if you cannot create the heat because of the eddy current and to exchange?
Saturation can make a lot of heat. Over to you, Roy.
Yes, I agree with Nick. It's not a true eddy current, but individual grains can all pick up magnetic bursts from a high voltage static discharge of a lightning, and it could be in the kind of melt the grain structure in each little teeny grain.
I have a problem with that, but you got something good. You have 100 kilohertz frequency, and that ferrite is made to work at this frequency. If you deliver the higher frequency, you're actually changing the domain. Is actually getting to stall. That means it's at a certain frequency, it cannot change. Am I understanding you do good? Is that the cause of the damage?
As far as I can see, it's not the cause of the damage, it's the result of the damage.
So what is the cause of the damage? Because then we're talking about energy. The energy delivered to damage is the energy that eventually may be attached to the transmutation, which is producing the energy. And to exchange.
Well, I do not know what is the cause of the cascade failure that N2O suffered. Some have conjectured it's lightning. So think of it as a lightning bolt coming down your antenna and finding your lovely little piece of ferrite, which is minding its own business, but it suddenly has to deal with a very, very large voltage potential, a lot of current, and a very, very short duration. And those little grains are going to suck up that energy and produce heat.
Thank you very much for that explanation. I have never seen the ferrite antenna, ferrite rod, to be damaged in my life. And there were plenty of radios that were influenced by lightning strike. And to exchange.
It's not a common cause, but it is a cause, and if you have a better solution to the puzzle, feel free.
Yeah, in the future weeks, I believe that Andy's going to do some further tests, so we'll find more about this. I got another guess going on here. When it comes to taking a material that's capable of making a permanent magnet, you put a very strong magnetic field across it to magnetize that material, and you're taking the individual domains and their orientation and lining them all up. I wonder if there's any kind of, in the procedure for producing the ferrite toroids or powdered iron toroids, when you produce any of these materials, I wonder if there's any kind of a grain alignment of the domains that takes place, and with overheating, could that domain alignment be lost as if you had demagnetized a magnet? I mean, a permanent magnet, if you bring it above a certain Curie temperature, I think it's called, it'll lose its magnetism. So a magnet losing its magnetism and ferrite losing its permeability, there may be a relationship there. Any guesses on this one, Roy? AC2GS, KQLAW, and the deck net? Just kind of go there.
If I understood properly, permeability is a function of frequency for ferrite materials. Does the permeability change with the frequency change and to exchange?
going to go to Roy and then Eric in that order. Eric steps on the end of this. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, there's a whole bunch of terms that we kind of agree upon. Permeability is the ability for a material to store magnetic fields. The same thing as permittivity is ability to store electrical fields. So that's permeability. Iron and nickel and cobalt are called ferromagnetic because they can hold on to a field. You could magnetize them and stay magnetized as long as they're below the Curie point where they get their spins scattered statistically. I think ferrites are more paramagnetic. They're magnetic in a magnetic field. You cut the magnetic field off, they lose their magnetic moment. So you don't charge up a ferrite. You don't have to give it a magnetic field or anything. But all these things, if you heat them beyond a certain point and allow their electrons to spin all over the place in different paired, unopposed positions, will lose both their magnetic dipole moment and their permeability while they're at that temperature.
KE2EJ, Eric, please tell us what you've discovered on this one. K2LIW.
Well, interestingly enough, I was going to mention the Curie temperature, and I went to ferrite, which I probably buy my ferrites from, and they have a table of the properties of what they call soft magnetic material, and they list the Curie points of them, and depending upon the combination, whether it's ferrite, nickel, and zinc, or ferrite, manganese, and zinc, the Curie point changes. And the stuff that we use is pretty much in the toroid, really have low Curie point temperatures. So you can actually make it, you know, lose its permeability by exceeding those temperatures on a permanent basis, according to this.
WY2U.
WY2U, please proceed.
Hey, good evening, Dick, and all to the net. This is Mike, WY2U. I've been listening for a bit. And you know what? I'm sort of skeptical, believe it or not. I'm going to throw a monkey wrench in your discussions here about the permeability losing all of, I mean, I'm sorry, the toroid losing all of its permeability. Even if it went to unity, which is air, you're still going to have an appreciable amount of inductance in the primary and the secondary of that transmission line transformer to the point where it will not produce an infinite VSWR and reflect all the power from the secondary to the primary. Yeah, it may look like a 5 or a 6 to 1 VSWR if it looks like a 50-ohm reactance, which is what it would be, by the way, assuming it's about a microhenry at 20 megahertz, 20 meters, rather. Let me drop a minute. So I'm taking a different spin on this. A lot of the modern designs of the balance use what I call peaking on one side of the transformer element or another, where they actually put a small, maybe 10, 20 picofarad mica capacitor across the inductance to ground in an attempt to try to peak it a little bit, remove some of the residual magnetization inductance, and try to get a little more frequency response out of the network. And that's pretty effective up to a point. Any leakage inductance shows up as a series L, which in conjunction with this capacitor that they use as peaking can actually act as a primitive low-pass filter of sorts and extend the frequency range of the network. I'm just wondering if it's not something silly like that capacitor, assuming it exists, if whether or not it got shorted due to an electric lightning stroke or overpowering or whatever, and there's nothing wrong with the magnetic material at all, and it's really a failure in the cap. And I'm just wondering if that's the case. Back to net, WY2U.
This balance doesn't have any capacitors, by the way.
Okay, that settles that. Thank you.
The replacement design does have capacitors. This particular design that they've abandoned has no capacitors. So do you have any feeling for what could be the failure mechanism within the ferrite that Jerry Sarek, W2FMI, was reporting on? Well, then when you overheat these things, apparently beyond the Curie temperature, you get some drastic change. Any idea what's going on there, Lou? I mean, Mike, WY2U, K2RIW. Glad you're joining us.
Oh, I absolutely agree with with the discussion that if you overpower and saturate a ferrite well beyond its linear characteristics, you most likely will do permanent damage to the chemistry inside the material. I'm skeptical of the fact that the permeability just goes away. I mean, I can see it degrading so that instead of having a permeability of a couple of hundred, it has a permeability of several dozen. So your 89 microhenry inductor, whatever it is, will be about 10 microhenry inductor. But that's not going to give rise to an infinite VSWR manifestation. It's going to be something a lot less than that. It may not work anymore at 80 meters. It may be kind of marginal at 20 meters. But it still should be a transformer of sorts. So I think there might be something else going on, guys, that we're missing, in my opinion. Back to net.
There's one other piece of... Let me drop this. There's one other piece of data here. His inductance measuring machine, we don't know what frequency it works at, 1 megahertz or 100 kc, puts in a very low-level signal. He tried putting in 100 watts. Can you think of a failure mechanism of the ferrite that's been overheated beyond its Curie temperature, where it now saturates at a much lower power reading? I mean, this balun, I think, is rated for a kilowatt. Andy was trying to check it at 100 watts. The VISWA was so high, he was getting a fallback. I think he was only getting 10 watts in, 10 watts forward, and almost 10 watts reflected. So could our failure mechanism of the permeability material become very power sensitive? Is there a possibility on that one that you see, Mike? Did it light to you, K2RIW?
Yes, I do. In that particular case, I do, because the saturation characteristics of a ferrite depend greatly on the magnetic volume, the magnetic core area, etc. And if you drastically degrade the permeability, which is interrelated to everything, AL value and volume and all of that, I can see the ampere turn saturation region actually dropping. That would be an interesting experiment if he could somehow, Andy, that is, reduce his output drive from 100 watts down to a couple of watts and then measure the VSWR. If you notice the VSWR starting to improve, that would put credence in what you're saying. But whether or not it's going to reduce the saturation characteristics by, what, 10 dB? I suppose it's possible, although it sounds a little far-fetched to me. WI2U.
When Andy was doing this test, let me drop this. From his source of signal that was capable of 100 watts, he went through a bird watt meter into the balun, into the good dummy load. So by weight of his bird watt meter, he can try various drive amounts of power, 100 watts drive, 10 watts drive, 1 watt drive, and so on. And by way of the bird watt meter with the right slugs, he could measure forward and reverse power ratio and know exactly what the standing wave ratio is at each power level. That sounds like a very interesting test, in which case we may find out the balun works great at 5 watts, but not above because of the change of the permeability material that happened because of the overheating. So I think you got a good suggestion there, Mike. WY2U, K2RIW.
That would be a very prudent thing to do. As a matter of fact, if he has a scalar or a network analyzer, vector network analyzer, do the test at 0 dBm, whatever comes out of the Swift oscillator, and measure the VSWR as a function of frequency. Just sweep it. If it looks good down there at low drive levels, I think what you're saying makes sense there, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, for the last week or two, Andy has been threatening to use his vector network analyzer on this balun to see what he sees, whether or not it's got a frequency-sensitive component. And yes, VNAs, I think, tend to run around plus 10 dBm unless you reprogram them some other way. So the possibility exists that at the 10 milliwatt level, the thing behaves hunky-dory, which under ordinary circumstances would create quite a bit of confusion if you didn't know that there's this saturation characteristic. I think most of VNAs run around plus 10 dBm. Is that your recollection also, Mike? WI2U, K2RIW.
They're capable of outputting plus 10 dBm as a maximum drive level. We just bought one for school, by the way. It's a new product by Tektronix. I don't remember the model number. Default value is 0 dBm, but you can increase the drive up to plus 10. And interestingly enough, if you want to use the same vector network analyzer to measure, let's say, low noise amplifiers, they allow you to program the drive all the way down to about minus 50, so that this way you don't saturate a gas FET in the front end and get crazy readings on the linear characteristics of a low noise amplifier. So yeah, I'd say anywhere from 0 to plus 10 dBm sounds like it should be about the default level there, Dick.
That makes a lot of sense, because you do use a VNA on solid-state circuitry, like preamplifiers, and you don't want to damage them and or saturate them, which will give you a false alarm reading of apparent reflection coefficient. So, as you can tell, Rich and 2EO, who asked the original question, further research is going to take place on your balun. We got more and more evidence that it has failed, that it does require replacement. You're in the process of replacing it. We have reason to believe that your particular balun has a failure mode that's permanent for that particular material. There's no way of just replacing a capacitor or getting rid of a short circuit to bring it back to life. So looks like you're taking the right approach. And 2EO, for any final comments, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
I'm replacing it, like I said, I'm ordering it tomorrow. Germany, that's Patty's son, is lending me the money, and as soon as he gets done taking his kid and ordering. I want to ask you, is there any type of lightning suppressor for open wire line? I have never seen one. Ones that made by Alpha Delta and other things, they work, but they're made for coax. Does anybody know of one made for open wire line? Back to you, Dave.
Yeah, if anybody would know about that, it would be Eric. I'm going to go over to him in a minute. However, the chances of lightning striking your antenna is a very slim possibility. On top of that, this new balun has a lot more rugged construction, in which case, for all I know, it would survive a lightning strike with no real damage. So whether or not you really need an open wire line lightning arrestor is questionable with the new balun you're about to buy. I'll bet you there are open wire line lightning arrestors, but the way your open wire line comes into a high point on the house and then goes in the house to the balun to bring a real low inductance lightning arrestor into that situation would be mechanically a little bit difficult, I think. Erica, have you seen open wire line lightning arrestors? K2EU, K2RIW, Eric.
No, I don't know if I would call them open wireline lightning arrestors, but on AM broadcast transmitters, which are actually fed single-ended, but it balanced to the tuning houses. They're gas discharge devices, and they're big, but then again, we're talking about lots of watts. But as far as like 400-ohm wireline, for the AM world, I have not actually seen any.
AC2GS?
And Erica, forgive me for calling you the wrong call letters, KE2EJ that was. Go ahead, Roy.
Italy Solutions has one. They call it a AS309H twin wire line, ladder line, open line surge suppressor for a little bit over $100. So they are doable. I don't know anyone who uses one, but they are doable.
Please repeat that brand name. You had a slight dropout when you gave us the brand name, Roy, go ahead.
Okay, I'll try once again. It's Array Solutions, a very popular brand of rather sturdy equipment that ranges from inexpensive to ridiculously expensive. So Array Solutions, and the item is designated Alpha Sierra 309H.
Very good piece of research. Thank you, Dr. Roy. Okay, we're going to go over to John, the next person who signed in with a question or a comment. Whiskey 2, Golf Whiskey, K2RIW. You got it, John. My name is Dick.
Thank you, Dick. I have a question. I'm glad to hear that Eric is on frequency. Eric, is the Glen Oaks DMR repeater up and functioning at the present time? Over.
I'm sorry, I was a little away from the radio. Could you repeat that for me?
Yeah, my first question is the Glen Oaks DMR repeater up and running at this time?
As far as I know, it should be. I can check for you if you really want to know.
Well, I've been away from DMR for couple of years anyway, recently got interested in it again. And I found it used to work, but doesn't work anymore. So I figured that the phone number had changed. Not the phone number, the frequency had changed. Can you give me the current frequency of the Glen Oaks machine for DMR?
Yeah, I can. Or you can too if you just go to just do a Google search for Bronx Turbo. All the machines that are on the system are listed. So give me a second. I'll give you the frequency of Glen Oaks. You know, there's a machine in Plainview, there's a machine in Selden, there's a machine in Malvern, and there's a machine in Oceanside.
Oh, roger. And is the frequency the same for each of those? I guess not.
No, each one is on a different frequency, so, you know. Let me get you... The frequency of Glen Oaks is... actually, there's two machines on Glen Oaks. There's the Limehouse Associated one, and then there's the JRC. JRC has only got the TG44, which is the Bronx Turbo Talk Group, and Disney down in Florida. Let me find it. Here it is. Okay, let me let it drop. Okay, the machine on Glen Oaks is 438.51250, minus 5, of course, and the color code is 1.
Thank you, Eric. Yeah, that's the fourth frequency that I have for that particular machine. That's the Limark machine.
Well, it's just Steve's WK's machine. He does carry on the second time slot the Limark talk group. So I don't know where you're located, but there might be a machine closer to you. But anyway, on the slot one side, it's got all the normal stuff, which is Bronx Turbo, Worldwide, North America, Worldwide English, you know, TAC 310, 311. He's also got DMR Plus. I don't know if you're aware of that, but that's over there.
I guess DMR Plus is over my head right now. But, yeah, I have the reason I got interested again is, you know, I heard... The presentation at the last Limark meeting about hotspots. So I put one together and got it working, which was a little bit difficult, but I got it working. And I'm able to use it with TAC 310 and all the other talk groups except Limark. And I have Limark on time slot 2 and color code 1 and so on, so I understand all about that stuff, and it just doesn't work with the so I thought I'd go RF, which used to work. Now it doesn't work here from here for Glen Oaks, and I tried to look up the frequency on several websites, and I get a different response from, you know, for each one. It must change all the time for some reason, or it must have changed several times.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
What is the timeout on this thing?
Too bad, my sister, correct.
My hotspot is is Brandmeister, over.
That's what I said. Well, actually, because I don't have control over Steve's machine, I don't know whether his particular machine is attached through the sea bridge. But I know our machines are, and that's the machine in Plainview and the machine in Sheldon. So I don't know where you're located, but you might try going from them, and that will get, because once you get in, then it'll go through all the machines.
Yeah, they're too far away from me here. I'm in West Hempstead. I just about make the Glen Oaks.
I don't know why you just about make Glen Oaks. You shouldn't have any problem making Plainview. West Hempstead, no big deal.
Okay, I'll try that. Do you have a number? I mean, a frequency? I keep thinking phone number. Do you have a frequency for south? What is it? Plainview.
You know, you can do this yourself. And, if you want to actually go to it, this is m2nsa.net. I'll get you to the page, which has all the frequencies, but I'll give you the Plainview frequency. Actually, the Melvin machine and the Oceanside machine might be good choices for you, but then again, I don't know. I assume that they are. I know that Jeff would make sure that things are happening. But anyway, the Plainview frequency is 449.375. Everything else is the same, you know, minus 5, color code 1.
Okay, 449.375. Yeah, that's what I use for 440. The analog in Glen Cove works fine on that frequency. Malvern is very close to me. And would I be able to get the Limark local talk group from Malvern?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's at Steve's house, so, you know, it's not that high up in the air. Then Jeff's machine's in Oceanside, which is, I don't know if you draw a straight line, it might be closer, maybe it's not. But anyway, go to n2nsa.net on the web and you can see everything.
2 November Sierra Alpha.
Nancy 2, Nancy Sierra Alpha dot Nancy Edward Tango.
Okay, thanks, Eric. I'll go to have a look at that. That helps me a lot. Okay, back to Dick there, K2RIWW2GW.
John, did you say you had two questions, John? Go ahead.
I didn't enumerate them properly. I sort of dumped them all on Eric. And he's very knowledgeable. I know about these things, so I'm sure he's helped me a lot here. Okay, thanks a lot, everybody. And W2GW will be now clear.
Very fine, John. Next person with a question was Paul, WS2N. Go right ahead with your question, Paul. K2RIW in the tech pad.
Okay, this is WS2N. Yeah, a question on teaching. If you're teaching somebody or a group or a class, you're trying to explain the basic circuits that are resisting, you know, resistors and series. They might be lights, they might be something, fans, whatever they might be. You might have a power supply behind it. Could be a battery. You know, they could be talking about AC. They use the word draw, D-R-A-W. A lot of writings when, you know, you're trying to explain something to somebody. And the question seems to be coming up about the word draw. Now, my daughter is going through this. N2WIN teaches. And once in a while, she'll try to teach basic circuits. And that question comes up. Using a different word or trying to explain it differently, or maybe that's the right word. Because, you know, it seems like when they use that word, draw, it's like sucking in the electrons, you know, from the circuit. You know, I'm looking for a better way, a better explanation if you're going to be teaching a group, Dick. You know what I mean?
Don't
alpha with you.
Delta Oscar Whiskey. What are you about to say, sir?
I'm asking Paul to clarify, but I didn't hear carefully what he was saying.
Okay, he's asking about the meaning of the word draw. When a teacher is explaining LRC circuits, and the word draw is used, I think it's usually used with reference to current drain, current draw. I'm going to give an example of one place where I think it could be used. If I had a very simple circuit, like say for instance a flashlight battery in series with a milliamp meter in series with a resistor that goes back to, stand by a minute, I'm getting some funny noises out of my rig. The flashlight battery goes to a milliamp meter, goes to a resistor that you can select, and the bottom of the resistor goes back to the battery. As I change the value of the resistor, say for instance a 1.5 volt battery, and my resistor is always going to have 1.5 volts across it in that circuit if the milliamp meter is perfect. As I change the value of the resistor, the amount of current drawn from the battery will change. If I had a 1.5 ohm resistor, I would draw 1 ampere. If I had a 15 ohm resistor, I would draw 100 milliamperes, and so on. So the amount of current that is drawn from the battery, because the battery sees a particular impedance of the rest of the outside world, that's one way I've seen the word draw used, current drain, how much current is drawn. Draw could also be used for the method by which you use a pencil and draw a circuit on a piece of paper. I don't think that's the way you're using it. So draw, I think, is quite often used with reference to current drain. Does that seem to fit the particular circumstance? So Paul, WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
Yeah, that justifies the use of the word draw. But the idea was, if you had a circuit just going from positive to negative, and there was nothing in there at all, and I know that the electrons are going to fly through that wire and heat it up. But, when you start putting something in between, young people that are learning this, when you use the word draw, they think that, this is like creating a vacuum and it's sucking the electrons out of the battery. And I just don't think that's a good way to teach it. Although maybe it is. I was just looking for something different. Because, the question came up. So I thought I'd see what you guys thought. To me, the circuit is going to be there whether something is there or not. It's a question of the resistance, how much resistance is going to be in the circuit. So, I don't know. That's how I got involved with this back user.
What about accept, take, gather, or use?
Those sound like possible synonyms. So the resistor will accept X amount of current. It'll take X amount of current, depending on how much resistance there is. I mean, in various circuits, there's ways you can find out what voltage is being applied. In my very simple battery circuit, exactly 1.5 volts is going to be applied. So therefore, how much current flows could be called draw, accept. And what were those other words you used, Roy? So by using those synonym words.
Repeater, timeout.
By using those synonym words, that may help convey the concept, Roy. Paul, go ahead.
Yes, I like that. That's good. The confusing comes in when, you go to a store and they'll say, well, this refrigerator is only going to draw this amount of power, or compared to another older refrigerator that used to draw this amount of power. And, it's a common term, but when you're teaching it, I like Roy's couple of words there. And I'm just recording this part of it this way I can play it back for my daughter. She's not listening at this time, but I'll play it back. And that's very good, Dick. We'll use that. Back to you, WS20.
little bit complicated if you've got multiple resistors in series, and or at least one resistor going to a load, and now you try to figure out how much voltage or current, how much voltage or current will take place in the loop as you change that the value of that resistor between the power supply and the load. There are things.